afternoon. My name is Beth, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the DSRIP PPS Compliance Program conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. Thank you. Peggy Chan, you may begin your conference.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Peggy Chan, the District Program Director, and thank you for joining this call. As in terms of the participation in the District Program, one of the requirements is for all the PPS leads to establish a Medicaid compliance program. There have been lots of questions. Many of you are familiar and already have Medicaid compliance programs, and I think there have been questions, however, then what would be what would the PPS compliance program look like? Because we are clearly, we've got $6.4 billion in funds that potentially will flow to the PPSs, we need to have a whole structure, and we've been working closely with our colleagues over at the Office of the Medicaid Inspector General regarding, what would a PPS Medicaid compliance program look like. So I'm happy to introduce Matthew Babcock, who will be presenting today. I think you've all got the slides that were issued, that was sent out by email earlier, and they are also on the district website if you did not get that email. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Matt.
Thank you, Peggy. What I'm going to do is I go through the presentation. I will go through the slides and try to cue us into particular slide numbers. So if it sounds like I'm rambling in blue spot, you'll know where I am when I come in. The other thing that was attached just for reference, so I will refer to it a few times during the presentation. The email also included a compliance program self-assessment form that is also on OMIG's website. I would like to thank, on behalf of OMIG, the Health Department, Peggy specifically, for inviting us to come and speak to the group today, and thank you very much. And we hope that this will resolve some of the questions, and we'll make ourselves available with some contact information later if there's any additional at the end of the call. I'm up to slide 3 at this point. So this is our fine print slide. For those of you that know me, I'm an attorney, and so there always has to be some fine print in any presentation I do. The bottom line on this is that the presentation is intended to be guidance, and that the guidance may change depending on how things happen. But this is a good indication of what the state of affairs on February 26th at 3:10 p.m. In the year 2015. Up to slide 4. Goals of today's webinar, we will talk about the social services law, and when we refer to the SSL, or you see those in the slides, we're referring to New York State Social Services Law 363-D, as well as 18 New York Code of Rules and Regulations, Part 521. You'll see some of those sites on some slides later on. Up to slide 5, we will also have a very short discussion on the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005, and specifically when you hear me refer to the DRA, we're referring to 42 U.S. Code, Section 1396AA68, and again, there'll be a slide with that reference on it as well. This is an obligation that the PPS leads will have to address after the money starts to flow. This is not a requirement at the time of enrollment like the social services law requirement. On to slide 6. There's our reference there to the statute and regulation. We will go through at a high level the law and the regulations. If there's going to slide 7, if you need copies of the regulations, this is a screenshot of OMIG's website, and on the compliance tab, there are 4 items there under the compliance library. There's a number of forms, statutory references, regulations, and a lot of good information there that would be helpful as you are trying to craft your compliance program and operate it. Okay, up to slide 8, some preliminary matters. The OMIG recognizes that many, as Peggy indicated, many PPS leads are already enrolled as providers of service in the Medicaid program. As an enrolled provider, many of you are already required to have a compliance program and have a history of operating a compliance program. We expect that the PPS leads compliance programs will address DSRIP-related issues. The kinds of issues that a traditional provider of service has to address in its compliance program, as you would imagine, we would be much different than the types of issues that would be involved in meeting the requirements under the DSRIP program and the commitments that are being made there. At the very least, OMIG would expect to see a supplement or addendum to any existing compliance programs that reflect those specific issues related to DSRIP. And as a performing provider system lead, there's a certain amount of issues that we will kind of touch on as we go through further slides dealing with the oversight of those in the performing provider system. So the lead we would look to is having the compliance program that impacts all the operations within the performing provider program. The self-assessment form, which was the other document that was attached to the email earlier today, we think that provides a lot of detail on what we refer to as the 8 elements under the law and the requirements under each element. And that was designed and posted in January on OMIG's website, and it was updated from one that had been there previously. We didn't make any major changes to it. The law hasn't changed for those that have had compliance programs for a number of years and use the old form, but we consolidated it and made it a little bit more efficient for everyone. So for all the specific details, look at the self-assessment form. It was designed, it's available on our website in Word format. We encourage you to utilize that as part of a self-assessment, which for those of you that have a requirement to certify before April 1st, would be a good idea to self-assess your compliance program, and you can utilize that form. Up to slide 9, there are the performing provider system leads, the PPS leads, don't fit under most of the, well, don't fit under the article requirements to have a compliance program. But because they are receiving $500,000, at least $500,000 in a 12-month period, they will fit under the definition of a substantial portion of business operations. So this is really the hook that brings the PPS leads into the requirement of having to have a compliance program. With that said, your network providers or the performing providers in your system, they all may have independent compliance program obligations. And we think that the PPS leads should have an understanding of who in their performing provider system has an independent compliance program obligation and who may not. For example, someone, and I'll just use as an example, you may have individual physicians in your PPS that are not receiving over $500,000 during the course of a 12-month period. They would not have an obligation to have an independent compliance program. But still, even though they don't have an obligation, they are performing services under your auspices through your system and process. So you need to be sensitive to what they have, what they're not doing, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. Again, the money that will start to flow in the next month or so, a little over a month from now, is Medicaid dollars, and so that's why we connect in with the $500,000 level. The next thing I'd like to kind of do is walk through just briefly still on this slide that it's our suggestion that the PPS leads in their business and contractual arrangements with the performing providers in their system establish connectivity between their those in their network, and I'll use that to be shorthand for performing providers in the system, that you create in your contractual relationships with your network obligations for them to interact with the PPS LEAD compliance program. Potentially, there may be some situations where the PPS LEAD compliance program may need to have audits or investigations to take a look and check potential for fraud, waste, and abuse. And that what we are looking to have happen here is that the best way probably to address this is to start to tie in the network through contractual arrangements and acknowledge that there is a compliance obligation and that the PPS LEAD has a compliance obligation and that the network needs to support that. This would be true to a large extent. We'll talk about some of the elements that should be in a compliance program, that to the extent that the performing providers see an issue that might have program integrity implications, we would look to make sure that the contractual arrangements are such that the performing provider is communicating on up to the LEAD PPS compliance function. Okay, let's move on to the next slide, slide 10. This is where we're going to start to go through. We're going to walk at a very high level, each of the eight elements. And as you can see, element one requires written policies and procedures that describe compliance expectations as embodied in a code of conduct or code of ethics. Really what we look for at OMIG is, do the policies and procedures outline how the compliance program interacts and creates a way for the LEAD PPS to be educating and creating an environment for high levels of program integrity. Program integrity, when you hear me say that, the compliance function goal, the legislature, when they established the obligation for compliance programs, indicated that the best way to control fraud, waste, and abuse in the Medicaid program is to require providers, and in this particular program, DSRIP program, LEAD PPS LEADS, is to require them to have compliance programs. So again, looking at the self-assessment form under element one, there are a number of requirements under there that will help walk you through specifically what needs to be there. Under element number two, designation of a compliance officer, the thing that's most important to keep in mind and is sometimes difficult to focus on is that the compliance officer must be an employee of the PPS LEAD. There are some situations where if the PPS is in a larger structure, there may be some opportunities for some consideration of the employee being within a holding company, but we would, if anyone has any specific questions on that, we would suggest that they contact OMIG at the contact information at the tail end of the slides. But essentially what we're dealing with is having the employee, compliance officer must be an employee. When we think of an employee, we think of the employee as being akin to a W-2 employee, not a consultant, not an independent contractor, but somebody who is actually working for the PPS LEAD. And then the compliance officer, we're looking to for connections between the compliance officer and the PPS LEAD management, PPS LEAD governing board, and also have connections down through throughout the PPS performing provider system. Up to slide 11, we are looking at element number three, training and education. Any of the people that have an existing compliance program knows that probably one of the most important areas to get the word out on what is expected through element number one is through a training and education program. And we essentially are looking at training and education of all affected individuals. We don't necessarily expect that the training program for everyone in the performing provider system needs to be the same, but you need to be able to provide enough education to address those requirements that are on the self-assessment form under element three. Some examples are, you know, being able to talk about the expectations of the compliance program, how it operates and interacts, and how people can communicate up to the compliance officer. Element number four is the communication item. And when you look at element number four on the self-assessment form, you'll see that there is reference there to anonymous and confidential communication methods. Those are not the only way that people can communicate up, but the law and the regulations require that all the affected individuals, and that's all those that are connected into the compliance program or subject to the compliance program, must have an anonymous and confidential way to communicate good faith compliance concerns. And just by word, sometimes we have some confusion as far as what anonymous means versus what confidential means. Anonymous would be that the person who is communicating cannot be identified. So that would even be to the compliance officer. When you have a hotline with caller ID, that's not an anonymous method. And there are, we don't dictate what they would be, but there needs to be a truly anonymous method. Confidential, we have interpreted or held to mean that someone may be communicating to the compliance function, compliance officer, and the identity of that person may be known by the compliance officer, but if that person says to the compliance officer, do not tell anyone who raised this issue, the compliance function must keep that confidential. Element number five, disciplinary policies that encourage good faith participation in the compliance program. There are a couple of requirements under that element on the self-assessment form for you to focus on. But again, the idea here is that you have to have disciplinary policies. What that means in a PPS environment, it's discipline in that environment may be a little bit different than the type of discipline you're dealing with in a normal compliance function with employees. I guess conceivably what it could be is that a performing provider in a system, to the extent that there is fraud, waste, and abuse going on, it might involve the lead PPS removing them from participation or limiting their participation in some way. But again, what those disciplinary policies are and how they are implemented, they need to be outlined in the policies and procedures. And again, what we're looking for is that they're going to be uniformly enforced and fairly enforced. And by that, essentially what we mean is similar activities will be treated similarly as far as sanction, discipline, or anything along those lines. I think we're up to slide 12 now and looking at element six. And when we think of compliance programs, and I think this is element six and element seven are probably going to be the two areas where most PPS leads that have a history of having compliance programs are probably going to need to do the most amount of work in the sense that this is where element six requires you to have a system for the routine identification of compliance risk areas and non-compliance and addressing compliance issues. So again, a institutional provider that has a long history of Medicaid participation in the state who is now in a position of being a PPS lead has to start to focus on risk areas associated with managing and overseeing the program integrity of its performing providers in its system, not just the delivery of healthcare services, which it has historically been dealing with. And this is one of the areas that you might be in a position to be able to rely on as a PPS lead is to look at performing providers and doing risk assessments, risk analysis of how strong a program integrity system that they have. For example, if your network provider has a history of having a compliance program and is a long time institution with a lot of resources on its own program integrity functions, you might lower the risk on them as opposed to someone who may not have had a compliance program in the past, maybe not have needed one in there. So again, I think that the biggest area for focus for PPS leads would be to take a look at and the new frontier of risk that you are undertaking as a result of your role as a PPS lead. Under element number 7, once you're finding an issue, a risk, good management would require you to do something about it. And that essentially is what element number 7 does. And it's responding to the compliance issues, investigating those, correcting the problems, and preventing, taking steps to prevent their recurrence. You know, to the extent that you find a problem and correct the instant case, but don't do don't try to put in systems or controls to prevent it from happening again, just means it's going to happen again. So we believe that good management, just in general, but essential compliance programs are, when they identify a risk, are correcting it, potentially doing corrections, maybe self-reporting as necessary, but also to some extent, we think a best practice would be to do root cause analysis to try to determine why something happened and then correct it or put in systems to minimize that from happening again. Element number 8 is there needs to be a policy for non-intimidation and non-retaliation for good faith participation in the compliance program. And non-intimidation, non-retaliation are, I think, in this case, pretty you know, pretty well known for by most people. But again, I think that you would be looking at making sure that the, for lack of a, that the person who's identifying a compliance program or maybe involved in the helping to investigate a compliance issue is not being intimidated by other members of the PPS, not intimidated by the PPS lead management, and that there's no retaliation against them. So again, that's for good faith participation in the compliance program. Moving on now to slide 13. We've talked about the 8 elements, and those 8 elements are set out in 363D, subdivision 2A through H is the 8th letter of the alphabet, and so that's only the first stage. I mean, that basically establishes the plan and structure. The provisions on slides 13 and 14 are addressing what your compliance program must be applicable to. And in the regulations, there, I think that the lead PPS is going to be subject to more or less of some of these 7 areas. And on this particular page, I think that billing and payment tend to be the highest visibility for most providers of service. It's our understanding that DSRIP projects are related to improving the quality of care. We would expect a rather robust activity by the lead PPS in looking at quality of care and medical necessity issues as the compliance programs. We essentially, as we go out and would look at compliance programs for any provider, including a PPS lead, we would look for compliance connections in each of these areas. We don't expect the compliance officer to be the expert necessarily in each of these areas, but we do expect there to be some connections between issues that are identified there and at the very least reporting to the compliance officer that we found this issue, we've worked on it, here's our plan, and here's our plan to loop back and check to make sure that correction took hold and resolved the problem. So again, we don't look at the compliance, these responsibilities to be the compliance function, the compliance officer's function, but we look at these as being the enterprise's function with a connection to the compliance office. If we move to slide 14, mandatory reporting, credentialing, and other risk areas. Just briefly, I'm going to do most of my comments on item number 7, but just briefly on 6, kind of alluding to the point made earlier in the presentation, we think that a good practice would be for the PPS leads as part of any credentialing activity that they may be performing with their network is to make those inquiries relative to not only their licensure status and their ability to perform the services that they're committing to the program, but also if they're required to have a compliance program, one of the very, very basic things that can be asked as part of a credentialing or analysis of the network is give me a copy, this is the lead PPS saying to the performing providers or the network providers, give me a copy of your annual certification receipt that you got when you certified your compliance program as meeting all of OMIG standard, all of the requirements. And that is when you certify, for those that haven't certified yet, when you certify, there are two things that you get once you hit the submit button. The first thing you get is a page you can print that gives you all the information that you just provided as far as certification. The second thing that happens is that there is an email that is sent to the person listed as the compliance officer and as the certifying official that provides all the information that you just gave. So our recommendation is on credentialing that the lead PPS can certainly ask for a copy of those, either one of those two receipts as proof that the provider in the network that has its independent compliance program obligation has certified that they are meeting New York State's requirements. Now, let's talk a little bit about item number seven. This is the kitchen sink option. All of the risk areas that are or should with due diligence be identified. So this is an area that we expect to be fluid over time. And one point relative to that fluidity I just want to mention is OMIG expects that the compliance program and the compliance function that the PPS leads are involved in today will not be as sophisticated, will not be as strong as the ones that they'll have a year from now. Why is that? Well, they'll be starting to focus on issues and have some experience and know what rocks to turn over and what rocks can leave alone. So when you're looking at the other risk areas that are or should with due diligence be identified, we are looking at the compliance programs to be growing and developing. There are unanticipated risks that you're going to need to address as time goes on. We recognize that at any particular time, no compliance program can find every problem at the moment that it happens. And that, matter of fact, the real challenge of a compliance program is to develop a system that is more likely than not to find problems when they exist. Because we know that once you found a problem under element six, you are correcting it under element seven and resolving it and preventing it from happening again. So what we would expect to have happen is that we expect the compliance programs are regularly reviewed and modified to address the risks that are known and any new risks that come up. And if I haven't talked about the self-assessment form is a great thing to use to help you determine where your weak points are. And we recommend that you utilize that self-assessment form to add additional questions, additional concerns, and that can be the basis of developing what we like to see is a annual compliance work plan. Ideally, that's done not just once a year, but it's an ongoing process. And because you've got an employee vested with responsibility for the day-to-day operation of the compliance program, a good place for that to reside might be with a compliance officer. Up to slide 15 now. The mandatory compliance program certification requirement. OMIG recommends, as I mentioned before you certify, that you perform the self-assessment. And on slide 16, this is the regulatory authority for the certification obligation. There are two times that we are looking at the obligation for certification to occur. One is on enrollment, and there are some PPS leads that are currently that are going through the enrollment process with DOH. And as part of that process, they will need to certify that they have a compliance program that is meeting the requirements. When you go to OMIG's website, and I'll give a screenshot of that in a few minutes, when you go to OMIG's website and complete the form, one of the statements that is made at the end of the form when you certify is that you understand that making a false statement to a government entity could result in a fraud, could result in a misdemeanor or felony under the New York State Penal Law. So we wanted to sensitize people to the fact that when you're certifying you have something, you must have something. And if you certify you don't have it, there could be some problems associated with it. So it's important to keep in mind. So for those of you that are going through the enrollment process, you're going to need to certify, and I believe that process runs through March 31st.
Right, for any new corporation, we have said that, you know, there was a, you know, certain documentation that needed to be submitted in order to get other processes going. However, we understood that because of the nature of the compliance program and needing to have your compliance officer and other policies and procedures in place, that we would allow that certification to be filed at, no later than March 31st.
Thanks, Peggy. So once we get past, you know, for those new COs that need to certify for their enrollment process, that you're not done. I mean, it's an annual, and it's done in December, certification obligation. So as long as there is a compliance obligation, you must certify each December after you've finalized your requirements for the enrollment package. So moving to slide 17. Certification is only available on OMIG's website. It can only be done electronically. We do not accept paper certifications. OMIG has separate webinars that address how the certification can be accomplished. Moving to slide 18, here's a screenshot of the certification landing page from the OMIG website. Under the resources tab, there is a webinars sub-tab, and webinar number 25 goes through the current certification form and provides details and instructions on how to complete that. There's also, under the compliance tab, there's also resources in the compliance library that also keys into webinar number 25. So before you certify for those new COs that are in the enrollment process, we would recommend that you might want to take a look at the webinar number 25 prior to certifying. Okay, we're up to slide 19, and I want to spend a few minutes talking about the Deficit Reduction Act obligation, and this is based upon, I'm going to move to slide 20, this is based upon the federal fiscal year and a provider who receives direct payment from the state of $5 million or more. A direct payment would be going from the state, for example, to a PPS lead. Money that's going from the PPS lead to performing providers in the system is not a direct payment. That would be, we would consider that to be an indirect payment. With that said, there may be performing providers that are getting direct payments from the state for non-DSERP-related projects, and they may have a separate DRA requirement. But we wanted to sensitize, utilize this program to sensitize people to the fact that in December, at the same time that the social services law certification is up, there will be a DRA certification, and slide 20 goes through the requirements that must be in place in order to meet that certification, and it essentially deals with the Federal and State False Claims Act, some education obligations, whistleblower protections, policies and procedures. Flipping over to slide number 21, it does not require providers to have an employee handbook. But if there is an employee handbook, then there's certain stuff that needs to be included there, and it's detailed on slide 21. There is a possibility, probably more likely than not, that PPS leads might not have employee handbooks that would cover this. But again, keep that in mind. And we do look at the certification history for both the Social Services Law and the Deficit Reduction Act. They are two different forms. They're accessible both from the compliance landing page, but currently the DRA form is not something you need to worry about. This December 2015, you should be prepared for that. Slide 22, the DRA certification requirement, and when you go through the DRA certification, slide 23 and slide 24 outline a few of the points that we have there. Slide 25 points out where, again, the DRA certification is, and that's on OMIG's website. There's resources in the compliance library. Okay, we're up to slide 26. We're almost to the end. We've run the good race here. So just to identify some compliance resources, OMIG's website is on the top of slide 27. Compliance library I've referred to a number of times. Here's what's included in there. The Bureau of Compliance does not provide advisory opinions and will not review or approve compliance programs as they're being developed. The BOC does conduct compliance program reviews of and will be providing reviews of PPS leads as required under the Social Services Law. That schedule has yet to be developed. And when we do compliance program reviews, the legislature has directed us to consider the size, complexity, resources, and culture. You need to keep in mind that these eight elements and the requirements under each element are the same for a very large multi-million dollar institutional provider as they are for the sole practicing physician who happens to be billing the Medicaid program $500,000. So a large institution is obviously going to have a lot more infrastructure dedicated to compliance than a sole practicing physician, dentist, or other provider. Slide 28, those are contacts into the Bureau of Compliance's dedicated email box and our dedicated phone number and the Bureau of Compliance. We're very fortunate in that we have a number of very dedicated, hardworking individuals who are ready to take your call, and they will be able to help you walk through this. There are times that we do get questions that we don't have the answer to right off the top of our head, and we do need to do some research on it, but we will get back to you, we look forward to working with you that way. So we're up to slide 29, and I'm not sure if we have any. I know we're going to open this up for some questions. I don't know, Peggy, is there some contact or follow-up you want to have for people who might have questions after the program or not?
Yeah, Matt, what we can do, obviously, is start the question and answer period now. But for anything that isn't covered or that is thought of later, the PPSs can contact their district support team.
Great. Super. So we'll hold off on slide 30 till after the questions, and then I'll let you know how much I want to thank you for participating. So I think we're ready to rock and roll with some questions.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star and the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Your first question comes from the line of Susan Vandersummen from Bassett Healthcare. Your line is open.
Oh, we hope to be anonymous, but never mind. the question we have is, the lead entity has its own compliance program. The expectation is that now the lead entity will be responsible for every partner's compliance program as a separate compliance program, or is it another brand new compliance program for the whole PPS, even though it's not an entity? Or is it just an addendum to every partner's already existing compliance program that we just make sure they have something in place?
What we would expect is that, and again, you're going to need to craft this based upon your structure and the organizational format that that your lead PPS has. There needs to be, in the case of, and we'll just say for anonymously, that Bassett has a compliance program and it wants to continue to utilize the same compliance officer and essentially structure. What we would expect, what we think would be best, would be for the provider in that situation to probably develop some addendum or additional language that is going to be specific to the its new role as the lead PPS. How far down into modifications of its network providers' compliance programs it feels it needs to be to go, we would to some extent defer to the decision by the lead PPS on that. But what we would be looking for is that if the PPS lead has this great compliance program, but they can't get themselves down into the network provider, we think that that's going to be a weakness. So we need to have some connectivity. I'm not sure it requires the network providers to all amend all their compliance programs, but again, it depends on how the organizational structure is. So I think you can probably build on what you already have, just making sure that that the new risks are specific to lead PPS are covered.
So Matt, maybe we could talk about that a little further. As a lead PPS, they've got a network of providers. Most of those are Medicaid providers. The majority of those will already have their agency compliance programs. I think the example you pointed out previously is that, for those that already have certified every year, that could be part of a contractual, obligation as well, and providing that evidence to the lead PPS. And it goes back to, I think, your idea about your strong suggestion of the risk assessment now that there are district funds. So this isn't to say that the PPS lead really now takes charge of a whole Medicaid compliance program for all of the providers so much as it's now that it's got the added function of this district funding and where is this funding going, and it really is covered more in that realm, and that's what we're looking for, is that if these district funds are going now to the network partners, that there is now a compliance program now governing those funds.
Yes, I think that's fair. Fair summary of where we're going on that.
Okay. There's too many questions for that answer, but another question I have is on slide 16. It talks
yes.
about enrollment and certification, Medicaid provider compliance
yeah.
obligations.
Yep.
Something was not later than March 31st. Was it enrollment or was it certification?
We had asked all NewCos to make sure that they got in all their other information, such as pre-qualification papers in order to get vendor IDs. And then part of that new corporation filing was for to be a PPS lead had to do with, as part of the enrolling the PPS lead as a new Medicaid provider in the system, was the OMIG certification. So this specifically references the OMIG certification for the new PPS, new corporation, and that March 31st was the extended deadline while
okay.
we got everything going in the Medicaid system. If you're not a new corporation, then your regular December, end of year OMIG certification would be sufficient. Again, this is to point out that when you certify in December, that you have now a new range of activities that you should be including in your compliance program.
If you're a NewCo, Peggy, you know you're a NewCo, right?
If you're a NUCO, you know you should know you're a NUCO.
Okay. Okay. Good. Good. That's what we thought. But,
yeah.
Okay. Good.
Okay. Thank you. That's all questions we have.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Your next question comes from Advocate Community. Please go ahead. Your line is open. Again, if you queue up for a question from Advocate Community, please go ahead. Your line is open. Your next question comes from the line of a participant whose company is not available. If you queued up for a question, please go ahead. Your line is open.
What did you do?
We're unmuted.
We're unmuted.
We can hear you.
Hello?
Yes. This is... Is this Advocate Community or the unknown questioner?
I think the unknown was Advocate.
Right. Okay.
The unknown Advocate. Yeah.
Okay, good.
Reason you guys couldn't hear me. I just got a question that I think you answered in part, and that's we have a lot of individual independent physicians that are part of our organization, and you had mentioned some degree of oversight that we need to be involved in, and so I wondered what the specifics of that were and whether or not it was just related to the district funds or does it go beyond the district funds?
Well, our assumption here is that the PPS lead is it has responsibility for management and oversight of DSRIP related activities, including the DSRIP dollars. So I think that if, to the extent that we would be doing a analysis of a PPS lead and whether they're meeting their compliance obligations and interacting with the network, we would be focusing our attention on that activity and not getting involved necessarily in the non-DSRIP arena. So when you're dealing with one of the things to keep in mind is that the payment, and again, using the physicians as an example, the physician community is a kind of a unique situation in that in addition to getting $500,000 in payments, and again, that payment, that $500,000 threshold is payments from any Medicaid source, whether it be directly from Medicaid, whether that be under the DSRIP program or under from MCO, a number of MCOs under the Managed Medicaid program, we see all of that and bring all that together. So your network physicians, for lack of a better descriptor, they may have independent compliance obligations independent of their participation in the DSRIP just because they're getting funds from all different areas. But kind of going along the lines of the last question, we would look to the lead PPS to be focusing on accountability for the areas of that it has responsibility under the DSRIP program and looking for connectivity down with the network in that way. I mean, I think you have to rely to some extent a number of the PPS leads have hundreds or more of network providers. I mean, and
thousands.
Thousands. And there's no way that you can know exactly at any particular point in time who's the marginal player from an integrity perspective and who's a solid player. So, but again, I hope that's responsive to your question.
Thank you.
Sure.
Your next question comes from the line of Frank Chino from Mount Sinai Health System. Your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon. And just a further point of clarity, it sounds like this can be either documented, the lead PPS or DSRIP entity can either have a separately documented program to cover its DSRIP activities, or alternatively, coverage for the DSRIP partners can be accommodated through an addendum to that program. So I guess what I'm saying, maybe ideally there would be a a separate compliance program with its own materials, all in the name of the new LEED PPS's district program, or alternatively, is it fair to say that we could accomplish the same goal through an addendum to the LEED PPS's existing program?
Yes.
Okay.
You gave the options, and yes, it's to some extent it's going to be driven by what you feel is the most effective way to implement the compliance requirements.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Your next question.
Thanks for calling.
Your next question comes from the line of George Clifford from Albany Medical Center Hospital. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I think many of us last week at the payoff hearings heard from the panel their expectation that we engage community-based organizations in activities of DSRIP. Certainly, many of our applications, in fact, included specific ways in which community-based organizations would be involved. I think they're the hardest of the organizations, many of them in terms of compliance, because many of them currently do not accept Medicaid. They don't have a sophisticated infrastructure in place. We're already going to be asking them to conduct a relatively heavy lift for some of them in terms of IT data management and reporting. And so the question to you is, there's really two parts. How feasible is it to actively engage community-based organizations who have limited experience in compliance programs, an initiative of this magnitude? And the second part is, what, if any, technical support, what we might be able to expect from either the DSRIP office or OMIG in terms of trying to help educate community-based leadership in terms of what the expectations of compliance programs are?
Well, I think just in general, though, the responsibility for the compliance program, at least for at this particular point, is what we're talking about is for the PPS lead. And, you know, this isn't necessarily if the PPS lead feels that hoisting a compliance responsibility and all this on top of an otherwise non-Medicaid provider is unduly burdensome or unnecessary, what that may mean for the lead PPS is that there may be more outreach, compliance-related outreach that it is doing to the community-based provider. And so I think that, you know, where you run into this is probably going to be more along the lines of, you know, as you assess risk of your network of the providers in your system, you might look at a provider that isn't used to these kinds of control structures as someone that you may want to be interacting with more, maybe doing some analysis with more, and providing them with some more resources, both from an education and communication perspective. So, you know, this is our goal was not to say that every provider in your network now has to have a compliance program that meets these eight elements. That's not what we were saying. What we're saying is that there is a subset, probably a large subset of providers in everybody's network that has already got this independent obligation for a compliance program. But for those, and I think to some extent the PPS leads can rely upon that good work that they're already doing. But where probably the lead PPS's biggest challenge may be in these areas where there isn't those kinds of historical connections, and it may require the PPS lead to be doing more outreach, doing more education, making sure that there are good lines of communication up to the PPS lead compliance function if some issue, program integrity issue, fraud, waste, or abuse is happening down in the community. I don't know,
yeah,
is there anything else?
This Greg Allen also, George. We're hearing basically the same question keeps getting asked over and over again, and then there's this additional color about the non-Medicaid enrolled provider without a compliance plan. We did plow this ground on the health home program, where there's also a network, and some of those network partners were non-Medicaid enrolled, so they did not have an OMIG compliance plan requirement. And we did create some guidance for the lead health home with respect to their responsibilities for those non-Medicaid enrolled network partners who might be contracting to do care management or other services. So my recommendation is that we get some additional written clarity out to the PPS community on this broader issue of what is the responsibility of compliance assurance down into the network, and that we can work with the OMIG on that policy clarification with a specific subset clarification on those entities that have a compliance plan versus the responsibility for those entities that do not have a compliance plan. I think it would be fair for us to put some of that in writing for some of you to get a little bit more clear. And we can borrow from at least the spirit of the language we worked on with agency counsel on the non-Medicaid enrolled health home partners. I think there's some parallels there that we can utilize. But I think it's very reasonable to seek additional clarification and some additional written clarification on that. So we'll work to get that out to the PPSs.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Yeah, we look forward to that guidance. I think that would be helpful. I think an unintended potential policy consequence of not having clarity around this following a path of least resistance, PPS leads, and I'm certainly not suggesting that my PPS lead would do this, but it would be a potential tendency to avoid contracting with CBOs who didn't have compliance infrastructure. And I'm pretty sure that that's not the direction you want this to go in.
No, I mean, that's certainly not the direction that is required nor would be expected. I mean, there are many providers in the existing Medicaid program that don't have a compliance obligation. It doesn't mean that they're any less of Medicaid provider than anybody else. So, So no, that's certainly not what we at OMIG would expect, and I'm sure that that's not what, I'll let the health department speak, but I'm sure that's not what they're looking for either.
No, what we did on the health home side is the language basically says that you want to ask them for an assurance that they're not using people that are on certain lists of excluded providers, and you got some duty there. And then there's some duty to make sure that there's a fiduciary responsibility if you're transacting in any kind of monetary way with the entity, that they have some, you know, basic infrastructure to handle that. I mean, those are the two basic requirements in a non-Medicaid enrolled piece on the health home side. So I think we'd come out with something similar, but we'll think about this and get some written guidance out.
Great, thank you.
Again, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from Alicia Schickel from RR Health Strategies. Please go ahead. Your line is open. Again, Alicia Schickel, your line is open.
Hi, I'm sorry. I had my own phone on mute. I'm just wondering if OMIG has a formal plan to start auditing lead PPSs for effective compliance programs, and if so, when you would expect that would roll out?
We're still looking at developing a plan and putting some thoughts together on that. We have to interact some more with the health department and see how things are going. But I would expect suffice to say that there will be some level of review of compliance programs that are required for the PPS leads. I don't have a schedule yet, and what we would certainly try to do is provide some guidance before we started to do reviews. But if you took a look at the self-assessment form, that would give you a good roadmap into what you need to make sure is covered. Okay?
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
There are no further questions at this time. I will turn the call back over to the presenters.
Is there one more call?
Yes, we do have someone whose name is not available. If you queued up for a question just now, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. Yes, thank you.
Could you identify yourself, please?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Regina McGraw with the law firm Bond, Shenick & King in Syracuse.
Okay. Yes.
With respect to, I think this has been very helpful to understand how the PPSs can rely and build on other compliance programs, say with the lead entity. In the case of NewCos, is it okay then for a NewCo to enter into agreements with a lead entity or other partner organization to utilize either their compliance officer or to have them perform compliance functions for the NewCo? And I ask that because of OMIG's, you know, past discussions about independent contractor compliance officers.
Right. I think that what we would look to is that the PPS lead is investing in an employee who is responsible for the day-to-day operation of the compliance function. With that said, the compliance officer of someone who is not employed by the PPS lead would create some problems with that statutory obligation for an employee. Now, with that said, there's an awful lot that can be done through contracts relative to how that compliance program is being operated. You know, for example, when you're looking at things like any audits or investigations or inquiries that might be done, or communication and training, I mean, those can certainly be done by other members of the PPS, you know, on behalf of the lead PPS. But the law and the regulations are pretty rigid in that it needs to be an employee of the entity with the compliance obligation.
But it could be, so if a new co was formed, recognizing the ongoing responsibility of the lead entity, so not the new co, could the lead entity employ the compliance officer?
Is the compliance program the compliance program of the lead entity? When you say lead, is that the same as a PPS lead, or does it have some other meaning?
It's a PPS lead, but some of the PPSs have incorporated.
Yes.
So the lead entity may
three hospitals that have combined for a new corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the compliance officer is an employee of one of those.
Okay, is the new corporate new and the new corporation doesn't have any employees, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Legal structure.
That would be something that I would want to have a lot of questions on and look at. I think that we would need to take a look at that on a case by case basis. So if that's, you know, I would need to see what kind of connectivity there is between the lead PPS and the other entities. Again, we have seen in other situations where you have a holding company structure and you've got a holding company and the compliance officer may be not an employee of the holding company but rather an employee of one of the wholly owned subsidiaries. In that situation, it's all in the family, so to speak. I would need to understand what the legal organizational structure relationship is between the PPS lead and the new co. So, I mean, I don't know, there's some other thoughts here?
Yeah, sorry, this is Jason Gamm from the KPMG support team. I would just add, Matt, I fully understand the need to kind of look at these on a case-by-case basis, but I will speak generally to the fact that I think a lot of these cases were set up in exactly the way you just described, whereas it's a legal structure with no employees, and the one or very few group of entities that have any power over that holding company are the PPS lead hospitals with their own compliance program. So
right.
In that sense, I would suspect, I think case by case is, you know, definitely the appropriate way to look at it, and we understand that, but I think that many of them would fit the pattern you just described.
Yep.
So I think, you know, we can also, Peggy, if it's okay with you, in addition to looking to craft some language that will help clarify the situation around the, the situation Greg was just speaking to, if we could also, you know, put out a little bit of language around this, setting some general parameters
Absolutely.
Of what PPS leads should expect insofar as they are new codes with the compliance program.
Sounds good.
Okay. Did you have another question?
No, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Hal Sadaway. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, yes. We have a question regarding the requirements for the compliance officer. Do they need to have compliance certification, or can they be an attorney? And if they can be an attorney, can the compliance officer be also the legal counsel to the PPS?
Well, the great questions, and I'm going to talk about what New York requires and kind of allude a little bit to what the federal government requires, but the federal requirement may not necessarily apply, is not going to apply to this, to what we're going to talk about, but just to compare and contrast it. First of all, what you have in 363D and 521.3C sets out the requirements for the compliance officer. They have to be an employee. And they need to be able to have enough understanding of what to do to be able to do their job, to do the job satisfactorily. So there is not one particular discipline, accountant, attorney, consultant, that is endorsed. They're not required to be certified by any association that they have a certification in compliance. That's not required. Clearly, if the provider wants to require that, they certainly can, but we don't mandate anything. We would like to see somebody that has certainly some auditing, accounting, you know, some background in being able to conduct inquiries, audits, investigations. You know, they may not be doing that money, but they need to know how it works and to be able to do, for lack of a better phrase, root cause analysis if there's a problem. So somebody who we have in the past, not in this DSRIP arena, but previously we've seen someone who had been anointed to be the compliance officer whose job it was essentially to be the chief executive officer's secretary. We kind of found that to be a problem, not that she didn't have the secretary or the CEO's ear on things, but didn't have really the expertise to be able to do any kind of day-to-day operation of that. On the issue of being an attorney, that, you know, being an attorney does not mean you can't do it. The federal government in the reviews that they do on the Medicare program do not allow the compliance function to report to the general counsel or require, and they do not allow the general counsel to be the compliance officer. Now, with that said, New York State doesn't have that same limitation, although we do think that, pardon me, that a compliance officer, and again, by way of background, I'm an attorney, my wife's an attorney, my son's an attorney, full disclosure of this, although I think that being an attorney is a great thing for a compliance officer, essentially, when you think about what we would look for a compliance officer, when you just look at the eight elements, you're looking for them to be not only to investigate and review, but also to communicate, ideally educate. When you find a problem, you're communicating that problem out to everybody so that we can all learn from it, right? Well, the general perspective of most attorneys that are general counsel is risk aversion, and if there's a problem that's identified, you keep it quiet, you don't say anything about it, and you try to minimize damages and risks. So the philosophy is kind of
counter
on the two. So although there's no limitation in New York State that the compliance officer cannot report to the general counsel or cannot be the general counsel, we kind of follow the feds and say that that may not be the best structure. We might make a recommendation that you look for a different structure, but we certainly wouldn't find you anybody to be insufficient if that's the structure that they had.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Thank you for clarifying.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
And there have been quite a few Medicare, Medicaid compliance conferences and other training programs that have been out there. So, you know, again, those are provided pretty, on a pretty regular basis.
Right. OMEG, on our website, we have a number of webinars that we've done on compliance programs and more that we're required, we will be doing. They're all free. There's no, you know, you can sign up for them. Many of them have continuing legal education credits, have accounting CPEs and compliance CPEs associated with them.
Your next question comes from the line of Lourdes Martinez from Garfunkel Wild PC. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Don't be confused by the voice. This isn't Lourdes, although I'm sitting with her. This is Rob Del Giorno from Garfunkel Wild. How are you all doing?
Good, Rob.
So one of the questions we had as we're working on these compliance programs is whether DOH, whether it's KPMG or OMIG, you know, identified any particular risk areas as they've been assessing the implementation of DISRIPT that they believe, you know, if they came in and did an audit, what they think compliance officers should be looking at as they look downstream towards their kind of network providers. And also, is there particular types of data that's been, you know, identified that can be some kind of guide as we counsel people through this new structure? And, you know, it's a very new compliance role for people to assume and how they can be more effective in managing compliance for a DISRIPT.
Right. The first thing, and again, I meant to make this point during the formal part of the presentation. The Bureau of Compliance's role is not, and OMIG's role relative to the compliance program, is not to assess providers in meeting the commitments they've made under the DSRIP program and all that. That's the health department's responsibility and to do that. So, I mean, one good place obviously would be, you know, the organization, the lead PPS, and the entire performing provider system has made these significant commitments to the state and needs to make sure that they're working those. But again, those are going to be reviewed and analyzed by the health department. At this point, I think that what we're looking at is probably more along the lines of challenges that are related to how the performing providers in the system are interacting to identify fraud, waste, and abuse, and to try to take care of that, you know, when payments are going to be ultimately made. As far as the creation of the infrastructure, I would think the compliance officer is going to want to make sure that or be aware of anybody that is not living up to their commitments. Are they filing, you know, false reports and things like that? So, but there isn't, at this point, there isn't any data specifically that we have. I think that when you look back at the slides, that we had elements 6 and 7 on, there were a couple points that I made there that would probably be some starting points. Does the lead PPS have a system in place for responding to compliance problems that are identified in the course of the DSRIP project? You know, are self-evaluations being done not only by the DSRIP, the PPS lead, but also by the network? And how are those feeding up, you know, through audits? Is there a system in place to, for the for the prompt correction and resolution of problems and thorough investigation. I mean, a lot of this is system-based, is creating a structure to be able to doing this stuff, because, again, a lot of what's happening here, how the providers that have a history of providing services work, there's no, the DSRIP funds that are going now is not for provision of services and won't be for a couple years. So it's a lot of this is who's watching the store, how do you watch the store for these development funds and where that's going through.
Matt, I would totally agree. I think it's, again, this isn't the same thing as a Medicaid, clinical service program where a provider is filing for a reimbursement. However, there is payout of the district incentive funds, and so therefore, what is the underpinning for that payment? And is that, being carried out in the
right.
in the proper manner?
Right.
Is there the substantiation for the performance payment? Is there the, so I think that's what we're, looking for in the control, the management control structure.
Right. And Peggy makes a great point. I think that one of the things, one of the takeaways, at least from our view on a compliance program, is that, management in general has control structures that help it determine, make sure that the organization is running the way it expects to run. A compliance program is not the control structure. It is not the best control structure. It is a control structure that's in the quiver of what management tools that are being used. So, again, I think Peggy's point on that was right on the money.
Thank you.
Yes.
Your next question comes from the line of Bob Hassar from Mannix, Phillips, and Phelps. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Good afternoon, Matt.
Good afternoon,
my question, just an observation, it seems like that last point we can almost draw a parallel to the meaningful use audits that are occurring, given that those don't necessarily relate to the care but more of the infrastructure. But that's not my question. My question relates more to the timing, and you indicated that the new COs have to certify by March 31st, but the ongoing lead PPSs that are an existing entity aren't going to be certifying until, December 31st of this year. My question is related to your point about potential audits of these entities. I would assume the expectation is that these compliance programs will be rolled out across the PPS by that April 1st deadline, as opposed to waiting until they recertify down at the end of the year.
Yeah. Yes. Our expectation is that as the funds are rolling out of the health department, there are compliance programs that are there to provide the program integrity controls in place. And I think the reason why the new COs were required to certify by March 31st is that because their enrollment, they were required to submit enrollment applications, and the other entities that aren't new COs did not need to submit enrollment applications. But just because they didn't have to submit enrollment applications at this time, we are expecting all the connection points to be being implemented in those entities, because when the dollars start to roll around in April, there's a responsibility for oversight for that.
Very good.
Okay.
Thanks. Appreciate
Thanks.
It.
Thanks, Bob. Yep.
There are no further questions at this time. I will turn the call back over to the presenters.
Okay, I hope you all found this useful. I think this was a good opportunity to directly engage with the Office of the Medicaid Inspector General, as scary as that sounds. but they're actually very nice people. and again, if there are further questions, please provide those questions to the district support team representative, and they will get them to us, and we will review those and get out answers as we can. So thank you
Matt and Stephanie Coley, who is also here, and others.
Yes, thank you very much for the opportunity. Thanks for everybody participating, and thank you very much, Peggy.
Okay. With that, we can close the call.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.